residents at the Arala Centre will give the welcome to country.
Thanks. Hello everyone, as Kate says, welcome. Thanks for coming along. I want to firstly acknowledge the traditional owners of this country, the Yanawin people, pay respects to the elders, our elders, past and present, and pay respects to you that's gathered here today. I especially want to welcome Dr. Fran Botkin, otherwise known as Auntie Fran. Welcome to Armidale and welcome to Yanawin country. Thank you.
Oops, careful.
All right, started. So it is my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Frances Botkin. Fran is a Dharawal woman from the south area of Sydney. A keeper and teacher of traditional knowledge, Fran is passionate about the recognition of Indigenous Australian science. With her traditional understandings of environmental connectivity, passed down from her Aboriginal mother and grandmother, alongside Western University degrees in climatology, geomorphology, and environmental science, Fran is wonderfully placed to speak from the intersection of traditional and academic knowledges. Working with both Indigenous and Western methodologies, she possesses an incredibly sophisticated and holistic understanding of the environment. My own engagement with Fran's work stems from my research with Armidale's local Aboriginal community through the new Indigenous community garden we have put together in Nawan Village in East Armidale. And I've been working with both Colin Ahoy and Steve Widders up the front here on that for about a year now. This garden is sited on a block of land that was once part of an Aboriginal reserve. Re-inhabiting and reclaiming the site through an Indigenous-led community garden is a move of decolonisation. This decolonisation is partly about ecological regeneration of the site that has been traumatised by a violent social and environmental history. It's partly about strengthening community and providing an activist platform. But it's also about decolonising ways of thinking, a decolonisation of philosophy and the intellect. One of my favourite thinkers is an environmental and systems philosopher called Gregory Bateson, and he once said that there is an ecology of bad ideas, just as there is an ecology of weeds, and it is characteristic of the system that basic error propagates itself. It branches out like a rooted parasite through the tissues of life, and everything gets into a rather peculiar mess. I fear that the Western world is immersed and entangled in an ecology of bad ideas. The current environmental crisis and mass extinction event tells us that our ways of being in the world are broken. The delusion that human actions and the capitalist economy built on endless growth can somehow escape a planet of environmental limits is not only dangerous but ultimately suicidal, threatening the viability of the life of the human species and many, many other species on this planet. And I think this delusional disconnection is becoming increasingly terrifying. Australian Aboriginal philosophy has one of the most intricate and sophisticated understandings of ecological interconnection on the planet, where connectivities are noticed and responded to through a process of listening to country. Country here is understood as a vast semiotic matrix emerging from the agential non-human world. I believe that serious and respectful engagements with this rich methodology and epistemology can help begin to decolonise our thinking and disentangle us from the ecology of bad ideas we are mixed up in. So this week is National Science Week, and at the Garden we've been hosting an Indigenous Science Workshop series to promote scientific curiosity and the incredible environmental intelligence held in Aboriginal story and cultures to primary school children and high school children, and also to the general community. Fran has kindly agreed to present here today, and it's linked to our National Science Week activities in the garden. It's also supported by the Post-Human Research Cluster with funding from the School of Arts. And Fran will also be conducting a workshop for local Aboriginal kids from Minnabar School and Armidale High School at the garden tomorrow on Indigenous knowledges. So in 2014, Fran was named University of Western Sydney's Woman of the West for her dedication to Indigenous education. She is the author of Encyclopedia Botanica, the essential reference guide to native and exotic plants in Australia, which contains over 11,000 entries on Australian native plants. And in 2008, she published a beautifully illustrated children's book on Aboriginal seasonal and climatic knowledges called Dharawal Seasons and Climatic Cycles. Welcome, Auntie Fran.
Thank you.
So, Fran, you have a great passion for the recognition of Aboriginal environmental knowledge as science. I wonder if you could start by telling us a bit about what Indigenous science actually is and what it means to you.
Well, I can tell you what science is, and that is dealing with experiments and measurement. They've forgotten observation, and more particularly observation over thousands upon thousands of years. Right? And, of course, they've forgotten completely about experience. And this is where, if we can meld those two sciences together, our Aboriginal science and modern day science, I think we'll be able to achieve the answers to a lot of puzzlements that are facing us at the present moment. Mm. And that's what I've been trying to do. It all started with when I was a little kid. Mum taught me that the Aboriginal people recognised more senses than the white man does. The five senses, like hearing, taste, that's an important one, smell, sight. What was the other one? Touch. But we recognised another really, really important sense, and that was curiosity. And that is not at all taken care of in our schools today, or even when I was at school. You know, you do not ask questions. Curiosity was something that was absolutely forbidden. And yet, to me, when a child asks me a question like, why does this happen? That is something that is like a gem, finding a gem. I'm talking too much? Don't get me started. Yeah. No, but that's and this is something the Aboriginal people, well, I know Mum always, when she could, she always, you know, tried to answer my questions. Mm. And she tried to encourage me to ask those questions. But when I went to school to ask those questions, get out in the playground. You know? Don't sit in classroom, you're wasting time. Which is precisely what I wanted anyway, because I'd learn more out there than I could learn in the classroom. In our classrooms, we use only two senses, sight and hearing. That's all. And the kids are sitting there totally bored because the other three senses are going to waste. When I teach children, they're taught outside, where they can feel the wind in their face, where they can hear the birds, where they can smell the flowers. These are things you don't get in the classroom. Mm,
mm. So have you ever seen this engagement with, I guess that's a sort of that's part of that rich attentiveness, talking about, you know, to all the elements and all the connections. Have you ever seen that transform somebody? Does it have a transformative effect?
Oh, many times.
Yeah.
I'm going to use one example. We have a story down home called the Wurundjeri, the hairy people. And this is a story about a long drought, a very long drought. And within the story, there's a whole lot of lessons and a whole lot of, and a lore too. But more particularly, it's about a big hairy man who eats the kids who don't obey the laws. And the little hairy men and the people work together to finally conquer the big hairy men and trap them inside trees. And the only way that you can see that there's a hairy man in those trees is there's a crack in it so he can breathe. Anyway, I went to a kindergarten school, it was, and these beautiful little children. You know, there were 16 Aboriginal kids in the class, which was wonderful, you know, having that many of our kids there. But all the kids sat around, they listened to the story, and we went out into the schoolyard, and there is this beautiful Eucalyptus teredocornis, the forest red gum. There's one growing down near the gardens there, and with all its hosts. And they had a huge crack in it. And the kids were so excited that they actually had a doolingo in their schoolyard. Anyway, a week later, the principal rang me up and said, Fran, you've got to come down and talk to the kids. And I said, what's happened? I said, come down and talk to the kids. So I went down and talked to them. What had happened? They'd been feeding the Dooliga with their lunches. They'd been poking their lunches into the into the crack in the tree. But what was wonderful was they were doing it so he wouldn't be hungry when he got out and eat them.
Very wise.
But this is something that woke me up. That really inspired me that those children did that. And then I started to think, well, maybe we're starting with the kids too old, because at that time we were teaching kids from year 4 to year 12 so that they could get into uni. And I thought, we're going to start from kindergarten now. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're doing. We're working now with the kids in kindergarten right through, so that when the kids in kindergarten now get into first class, they will actually mentor the kids in kindergarten, the next lot of kindergarten through, so that you gradually get this mentoring of the older kids, of the younger kids. And it's working really well. There's only a few of us doing it now, but it's working so well. Mm. And these kids are going to be the scientists of tomorrow. So we can shape their little minds into using all four of the criteria for learning science. You know. It is, when I did science, it was stultified. It was laboratory stuff. It was horrible. I hated it. And then Macquarie University started the environmental science class, which was outside. And I used to think, why do we have to have it? Why do we, like, I was 30-odd then. I thought, why did I have to be 30-odd years of age to learn this stuff, which is actually Aboriginal kindergarten stuff? Mm-hmm. You know? And that's why we started teaching the kids. When so many in my day, you know, women weren't scientists. No. That's, you know, women had to cook dinner and stay at home and raise the kids and everything. And yet we still had brains that worked, mm-hmm. that thought and that puzzled. And I could never stand the fact that I had questions that couldn't be answered. So I made up a whole list of questions once and went through them one by one. Mm-hmm. And so many of our kids are afraid of university. Mm. So many of them are afraid. Sometimes I think there's a failure that they're afraid of, when actually learning isn't a failure. Mm. No, you learn what you can, and then you can push it a little bit further.
Mm. So storytelling is obviously a really, you know, all of this knowledge is, a lot of it is passed on through story and embedded in story. And I wonder, well, two things. What is it about story that holds the knowledge? How does that structure work, if that sort of makes sense? And the other thing is, in your own experience, what was it like to take these stories from your mother and your grandmother and then encounter a university context, you know, to have to do these, well, not to have to, but to choose to do these Western style degrees? Was there a big disjuncture there, or were they speaking to one another?
No. You could actually see the stories happening. You could actually, because most of our stories are based on place. Mm. And if you are lucky enough to find that place, and sometimes that place is in your heart even. Do you understand what I'm trying to say? Mm. That you suddenly see a place that resonates. And you know that that's the place of story. And then you can understand the lessons within those stories. Like Mum always taught me that there are three things that every story must contain. They must contain a law. They must be based upon a law, so that the children, when they hear the story, learn the law. Like the story of the Watanguri, the big hairy man, was if they'd... Because it was a long drought, if they had shared their knowledge, the humans had shared their knowledge of what to eat and how to find food during that terrible drought time, the poor Watanguri wouldn't have had to eat the children. Mm. So That was the law, you know, share, the law of sharing. The black snake story is another story, the story of how black snake, red-bellied black snake came to be. That's another one. But the laws and how can I get so passionate, I'm sorry. Yeah. The stories are so beautiful, combined with carvings on rocks of concentric circles. Not a spiral, but concentric circles. And they started to investigate that. Now, the preliminary date on that is 2.2 million years. So,
yeah.
Is the dating wrong? Yeah, this is something we've got to ask ourselves. Is the dating wrong, or have we been here that long? Now, the Americans don't want to know us because they say, oh, no, all life started in Africa, not Australia. The French are saying everything started in Australia. So we're going to have a war between the French and the Americans.
That's never
been known
to happen.
That's my husband there, so be careful. Yeah. Yeah. So, no, it's what is happening is that with the realisation that our knowledge is scientific, that our knowledge is about things that actually happen, but it's told in a cryptic form to protect it. And it has protected us, particularly from the early white settlers who thought they were nice little fairy stories. And so they helped us propagate it. But so I have to admit, my mother was the one that really... Mum died when I was 14, and she was sick most of her life, but she passed a lot of her stuff on to me. And what I didn't know was that she'd written down a lot of her stuff. And when she died, I was really upset. I was the eldest child, and she gave all her jewellery to my brother and all her beautiful things to my sister. And all I got was a box of paper. And I kept it with me everywhere I went, everywhere I lived. I took that box with me, but I never opened it. I wasn't game enough. And when...
Sorry, friend.
No, that's all right. It just reminds me, I forgot to... oh, that's all right. I forgot to turn my phone off. If it rings, I'll ignore it. Yeah. But my brother died, and my mum's youngest sister was at the funeral, and she just came up to me and she said, "What are you doing with your mother's stories?" And I said, "What stories?" And then I realised the minute I said it, what I had. And so I went home and I opened the box. And do you know what she'd done? When I was a little kid, before the other kids were born, one of the things that we had a law in our house, that when we went inside the front door and shut it, and we shut all the windows, we spoke this language. When we went to visit mum's friends and mum's relatives, we went inside, we locked the doors and the windows, and we spoke this language. And I asked mum once what it was, and she said, Spanish. Anyway, mum had died. And in my final year of school, just before I got a letter from the principal saying, please take this child out of school, she's suitable only for menial duties, we had a choice of learning a language. And we had a choice of German, French, Latin, and Spanish. This is done. I can do this. And I chose Spanish. And the teacher got up and she's talking this strange language. And I told her that that was not Spanish, that she was foolish, she ought to go back to school. And that's when Dad got the letter saying, please take this child out of school. So, and then when I opened this box up, it was about that thick of Mum's stories written in the language that I'd learned when I was a little kid. A lot of it I had forgotten, so I spent the next years, several years, trying to remember and trying to regather the language, which I did. And it's the Bidigal dialect of the Dharawal language. And at the present moment, I'm up to the T's of converting the Macquarie Dictionary to the Dharawal. even if it's never used, at least it's there forever. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully. But what was the question?
But that encrypting of knowledge, I find just fascinating through story, through, and I mean it touches on something that you know, a sort of tension, I suppose, between, on the one hand, you know, there's a colonial history of sort of cherry-picking Indigenous knowledge for certain purposes. I think it's been referred to as uni-tucker, you know, taking bits and just without contextualising it properly, without giving appropriate credence to the people it comes from, or even, any kind of engagement with those people. And I wonder, at the same time, obviously with these deep knowledges of climatic cycles and seasonal knowledge that seems to be much more accurate and knowledge of interconnection, it's obviously extremely useful, as we've been saying. And I wonder how you think about that tension.
I'm quite at ease with it because I've been cherry-picking white man's knowledge.
Yeah.
And using that.
Yeah.
Okay? I see knowledge as an amalgamation, a weaving of all knowledges. Mm. Yeah. I've realised how useful our knowledge is. Like that story of the guy, me and Lily, that I was telling you about, one of the offshoots of that, and this is something that really annoys me about, is our culture stopped 200 years ago. We can't make new stories about from the time the white man. I mean, there's some beautiful stories we could tell, you know, about the first contact between Philip and like, I'll tell you one story. Philip, in his wonderful time, he and Surgeon White were good mates, and they didn't like Botany Bay, more particularly because they hadn't discovered it. It was discovered by Cook. And they wanted something of their own. And this is in Philip's own notes, not his journals. The journals are the expurgated version. And so he and Surgeon White decided they'd go around into the next bay up to see how that was. Of course, and they went into what is now Port Jackson. And they camped overnight at what is now Barn Cove. And they woke up the next morning with a massive headache, vomiting violently, and really and truly sick and disoriented. They blamed the beans that they ate the night before. But I'll tell you something that we used to do. When our enemies entered our territory, we had a certain bush that we would burn, and the enemy would become unconscious. And while they were unconscious, we would paint them with white ochre. And then we would go away. The enemy would wake up the next morning feeling very, very ill, with a massive headache, vomiting, and all sorts of things. And they would look at their mates, and their mates were, had been painted with white ochre. They were dead. And they would all get up and run away screaming. We'd be in the bushes laughing our heads off. The point was, we'd put the bushes on the fire that night, snuffing while they were asleep. And while they were unconscious, we painted them. Unfortunately, with Philip and with White, we couldn't paint them because they were already white. Yeah, there's these wonderful stories. Another wonderful
story. They didn't jump up and run away,
aren't they? No, they stayed there. Yeah. Or the other story I really and truly love. When Cook first came out here, there was a man called Parkinson, an artist, and also a botanist on board the boat, the Endeavour, called Banks. Now, I believe that Banks never ever got off the Endeavour. He refused, but he used to send out the artist to draw things for him. And the artist came back with this drawing of a kangaroo. And he showed it to Banks, and this is in Banks's journal. He showed it to Banks, and Banks said, "That's a mouse." And Parkinson said, "Oh, no, no, it's this big, it's this big." And Banks said, "It's a giant mouse." So the kangaroo was classified as a giant mouse. Now, think about this. 18 years later, Philip comes out. Philip stops off in South Africa to have dinner with the governor or whatever. South Africa has cats, really big, but their mice are still only real little. Just imagine what it would have been that first night, camped around in Farm Cove, in tents, canvas, between you and the darkness out there, with the noises of the koalas and the possums, and worse still, the screams and the shrieks of the native quoll. Can you imagine what they were thinking? If the mice are this big, unfortunately, you guys can't acknowledge you've heard this because we're not supposed to tell their stories. But that's the whole thing. There are wonderful stories that we can tell. There's wonderful stories like one of his grandfather, great-great-great-grandfather, a man called Bundle. He was a wonderful, wonderful man, and yet he's completely forgotten. He was a man of peace. He was called the warrior of peace. His mum, the day that, or yeah, the Philip and the fleet had just arrived in Port Jackson, and his mum, Bundle was 11 years old. He needed to be initiated, but his dad had been killed in battle with the Bundungara, and his mum didn't have any brothers to take him through initiation. So she wanted to take him across to where his dad was born, over Manly. And she got a canoe and she was pushing it out into the water when a shark took her. And this little boy who was in the canoe jumped out and dragged just half of her onto the beach. Philip and the others recognised or saw what had happened. And they took him under their wing and gave him to Captain Thomas, I think it was, of one of the boats, one of the ships. He was the first Aboriginal man to sail right around Australia. Aboriginal person, sorry, because he was only a boy, to sail right around Australia. He was the first to sail to Mauritius. He was the first Aboriginal person to go to Norfolk Island. And when he returned, these long voyages, a young man, he decided he didn't like the sea anyway, but they said he was a great seaman, but he would not climb the masts. And I tried climbing one of those masts once just to see what it was like, and I had never been so terrified in my life, so I don't blame him. These are the stories. This man, he did wonderful things. He showed Throsby the way down the Macquarie Pass, going down into Wollongong from Parramatta. He showed them that way. He was with Borrelia and showed him to a certain way over the mountains, but wouldn't go any further because that was the country that his father was killed in. He refused to go any further. He was appointed the colony's first constable to catch all the escaping convicts and track them down. He was honoured by most of the settlers. When, and because he was a Dharawal man too, he was, even Macquarie said that he was a good man. But what happened was, there was some trouble, there was a big drought, happened in 1813. The Gundungurra and the Darug were allowed, as was the custom, for them to come down from the mountains and to occupy the lands, the Dharawal lands, because there was always plenty of food there. They came down, but they saw the white farmers there and the fences, and they didn't understand that this was, a different peoples. And they killed these strange creatures, the animals with the hooves. And they got into strife. And then one of the stockmen, who wasn't a very nice man, found Pidjigali, that was the Gundungurra war leader's wife, found her. They raped her, they killed her children, then they cut off her hands and then killed her. When Pidjigali found his wife and his children dead, he took the proper actions. He did what was his law, and that was payback. Because his wife and children had been killed, then it was his duty to kill the wife and children of the man who killed his. Do you understand what I'm saying? This was one of our laws. This was not a law of punishment. It was a law of prevention. Because how would you like it, killing someone, knowing that your closest relative would in turn be killed? The person you love most would be killed. So this was a law of prevention, but the white man didn't understand that. And so there was these skirmishes and these wars started, and then most of the white men fled into the Sydney and to Parramatta. But some of the crueler white men remained and were going to killing sprees. Macquarie then decided to get rid of, and these were his words, get rid of the troublesome blacks. And so he sent out three contingents of soldiers. One went to the northwest and found no one. Because that night it rained, and that was the duty of the Gundungurra and the Darug to return to the mountains. Once it rained, their country was safe again. So anyway, the whole thing was that the ones who had caused the trouble had gone back to their own lands. And the only people left were us. And we were, peaceful. We weren't good fighters. We were never good fighters. That's why we were good talkers. And we had to talk ourselves out of trouble. But we were the peacemakers. Mm. And I'll talk about that later. And they went back. And the only people left were the Dharawals. And that was the greatest, most horrible thing that happened. The remaining Dharawals were massacred. And it was the soldiers killed the men, but it was the stockmen who killed the women and the children, chased them forever. And that put an end virtually to the Plains Dharawal. There were five children survived. And Bundle. And Bundle went crazy because what had happened, he'd been in Liverpool when he found out that the soldiers were coming, and he'd been warned by the white men. And I have to say this, that he was accompanied by three white men. Warby was one of them, and Reeby, and I've forgotten the other one. Now those three came with him to help him try to warn the Dharawals that the soldiers were coming. They didn't make it to the men, but they made it to the women and the children. It was the women and children who were able to get up and pack up and run. But the stockmen had horses and they were able to run them down. And Bundle just went crazy. crazy. So he went out into the bush, and for 3 years he just sat there and just lived, just existed while he mourned his family. And but he then came back, and and Macquarie had appointed him the constable. But he was being paid in alcohol and in rum and in tobacco. And he didn't like tobacco because he considered that in our country, tobacco was a woman's medicine. It wasn't a man's medicine. And he didn't like tobacco, and he didn't like the alcohol because he didn't like the way it made his head go funny. And MacArthur sort of adopted him. And MacArthur pleaded with Macquarie to pay him in money. And Macquarie refused. He said, what does an Aboriginal man want with money? So MacArthur actually paid Bundle in money.
Yeah.
And he was able to build his little house, his little hut, on MacArthur lands.
Given this very sort of traumatic and troubling history, what role do you think engaging with Indigenous science, promoting this intergenerational passing on of knowledge and mentoring, what role does it play in social justice and decolonisation, do you think?
Oh, that's a Chinese question. Well, you know, Chinese puzzle question.
Mm.
What it could do is exactly what Bundle did. You know, he used his knowledge to benefit both the people on MacArthur's property. And I have to admit, MacArthur took many, many Aboriginal people in and protected them from the horrible drovers and that, you know, and protected the women. But in exchange, Bundle did pass on quite a bit of knowledge to MacArthur. For instance, one of the things that has really interesting, and nobody's taken it up, so I can tell you people and then you can think about it. Okay, there was a tree growing down our way called the Eucalyptus macarthuri. And they discovered, quite a wonderful tree. It has a beautiful smell. 4 days before rain, it has this most magnificent perfume. And so you had this wonderful warning about rainfall. It's going to rain in 4 days when you hear this beautiful honey smell. But when it rained, the trees are made so beautifully that, evolved so beautifully that they catch the rain that falls, and all the rain travels over the bark of the tree. And the chemical that's in that bark that causes that beautiful smell is gathered up by the water. That water was then used to wash our hair with. Mm. And it was made the hair soft and silky. And so they also found that they could get this same effect from the leaves of this Eucalyptus macarthuri. The Candon woollybutt, in other words. And so MacArthur actually started to feed his sheep with this wool. With this, the leaves of this tree and the water from the bark of the tree. And the wool grew fine and beautiful, and it brought great prices in England. Now, that was where our knowledge was used scientifically for hair or fur. Well, hair is the same in our language as fur. And there was that. Then there was a whole lot of other things that we were able to share, and Bundle was able to share with MacArthur, more particularly James MacArthur, that's John MacArthur's son. And so if we can share, and I've done this at our university. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether have I told you?
No.
Oh, okay. Yeah. What I've done here is I've taken Bundle's example. Mm-hmm. And what I've done is I've gone right through, I've poured through remarks from the old settlers and everything like that. With the Aboriginal man showed me this tree and said, this can do that, but the same tree growing over there can't. And so I started an investigation using modern day science to investigate why this tree, you know, sort of stops pain, but that same tree over there doesn't. So I looked around to find the differences. And what I've done, I haven't looked for the differences, I just wanted to find them. You know. What I've done in this whole, and it's over 3,000 pages, which I'm very sorry, but is I have marked all of the trees that grow around, all of the plants that grow around those useful trees and useful plants. Right? So that when and Mum used to do that too. She said, that one's all right, that one's not all right. And wherever that happened, I went back and I because plants fascinate me. They're the nicest people in the world, plants. Really, they are. And but they, she would show me these plants and then I would remember them, fortunately. And then, so I started to investigate. So I went around and every one of the useful plants that the Dharawal have used, I have listed their uses when they're growing with certain plants and other uses when they're growing with other plants. Mm. Yeah, that's right. I have marked their associations. Not just plant associations, because the insect associations are important too. And also, and this is it, science today looks at little spots here and there, right? Aboriginal people looked at the whole thing. And this is what science today is failing to do. They are failing to join the dots. They're failing to join all their knowledge together to get the whole picture. But we did that, and we've done it for thousands of years. Instead of just saying, oh, that plant is useful and that plant is not, we knew why that plant was useful.
In relationship with
everything else. Yes, in the association.
All right, I'll just open it up to the floor if anybody has any questions for Fran.
Oh, I totally got it. Sorry, yeah. Oh, I forgot the other two. Oh, they're almost as important as the law. The second most important thing is the lessons that can be learned from the story. And every story has these little hints in them. You know, like the story of the Watanguru that I was talking about was the Aboriginal people went out and they gathered, looked for where the dying or dead plants were. And they dug down and they would dig up the roots and the tubers and the bulbs that were edible. Okay. So that's, you know, in drought times, okay, so you can't eat the leaves and you can't eat the fruits because they're not growing, but you can eat the tubers. But there's also laws about taking the tubers. You can only take one tuber from each plant. You must leave the others. You take the biggest one, you leave the smaller one. So that when it rains again, those plants can grow back up again. So there's all these beautiful laws and lessons within. The little kurujas, the little hairy people who help the kids get out of the clutches of the duligas. They say that, and the little kurujas, they were fine because they only ate honey, and you always know that even in the worst drought there's always honey in the hollow branches of the trees. And so there's those little things, and the kids have picked those up when you're telling the story. They're just, you know, the kids grow. You can see them growing when you say, yes, you are, and you make a big fuss. So those laws and those lessons are very important. But there is one other factor, and that factor is, although it's not important if the kids don't pick it up, that third thing is every story must have a secret, right? And if a child asks a question that uncovers that secret, that child then goes up in a layer of you know, being able to learn more things, right? So that's earning the right to knowledge. It's like passing an exam. So, and sometimes the secrets are quite beautiful. And sometimes when the kids realise that they've uncovered a secret, what is quite remarkable that their own schoolwork goes up at the same time. Mm. So, it's, yeah, sort of... Mm. I wish I was a kid now. Yeah. But if I was a kid now, I wouldn't have the knowledge I got now. You know how it goes. Yeah. No more questions? Yes?
With the Aboriginal stories and the secrets, it just made me think of something there. I hear a lot that a lot of Aboriginal lore and stories is secret. So if Aboriginal lore and stories are to be accepted as science, how will Aboriginal people resolve
the secret stories you don't tell? Okay? Or you can tell if a person has gone through all of those levels of, you know, being proven worthy, then they're worthy of learning the secret. But you know, the secret stories. But if they haven't passed it, they don't know they haven't passed it. So they're not jealous or anything. Do you understand what I'm saying?
You've got to earn the right. It's not an inheritance, it's not a gift. You've got to earn it. Simple as that. Okay?
And
if you don't earn it, you don't get it.
Yeah.
And if you're not worthy because you haven't earned it, you don't get it. Simple.
He's more direct than me.
Sorry, but yeah.
Yeah.
People make a great deal of mysticism about it. So that's Whitefellow romanticism. It's a very straightforward, simple process. Because of your behaviour and who you are, you earn the right. If you ain't earned it, you don't get it.
Oh, I've got to tell you, this is Darawal. I'm speaking as a Darawal person. I'm not speaking as Anawan. I'm not speaking as Wiradjuri or anyone like that. I'm speaking as a Darawal woman. Okay? Our secret stories, the really secret ones, are never told except to an equal.
There's a lot of sort of information in the stories that aren't secret, which is, can quite happily be taken up.
Oh, of course, there's so much. Mm. Even now, sometimes when I'm in the middle of telling a story, I think, oh, that's something I didn't know before. And that's... Yeah, I haven't realised it. It's they're wonderful stories. They're like diamonds. You know, the diamonds have a face, and each face multiplies by the number of faces that there are there in the diamond. Do you understand what I'm trying to say? That you get these glimpses, and no matter how many times you look at it, they're different. An opal is the same. No matter how many times you look at an opal, it is different. And that's virtually what our stories are. They have this wonderful opal effect. And, yes?
Just following on from the previous two questions, if there's someone who does have a secret story and there's no one else worthy to pass it on to them, and they're coming towards their final days and they know it, is there any process that Yes or no, I suppose. Can... Is there anything that happens that that person might release it?
We've lost a lot. We've lost a lot of secret stuff. But that's not to say that it can't be found again.
Absolutely.
Okay? And this is where I'm hoping it can be done. Is because, like, for instance, we've got stories of at least four different ice ages. Four times when the sea levels were 3 days' walk further to the east than they are now. We've also got stories when four times Sydney was just a group of small islands. The only thing sticking up out of the water was South Head.
The base of the Blue Mountains was the coast.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and...
Knowledge is lost from consciousness under those circumstances. And it's unlost from consciousness.
But there's, and
knowledge is derived from the earth. Mm. Okay.
Yeah, and that you're right there. Our knowledge is derived from the earth, and while ever the earth remains, that knowledge is still there. We just got to re-find it again. Mm. Okay. When we go back down to the coast again, when the sea levels are way down. No, they've got to come up higher yet, haven't they? Yes, they have to come up higher yet. Mm. A good. Yeah. Oh, you know what I enjoy about this? I truly and honestly enjoy about this is when the sea levels come up, just imagine Botany Bay, Gunnamatta Bay,
Rose Bay, all the wealthy suburbs of Sydney.
All those beautiful houses. Can you imagine what's going to happen to them with a 4 metre sea level rise? Doesn't it make you feel good? They'll have plenty of lives won't be lost because there'll be plenty of time for them to get out. They've just got to stand there and watch the water come up over their knees and their beautiful homes. But the thing that worries me with the present governments that we have, we probably have to pay compensation for all those lost houses. I'm being facetious. Sorry again. Yeah. I didn't answer your question, did I?
No, you answered it very well. And thanks to you as well. I'm not an expert in the question I'm about to ask, but I've heard that the anthropological evidence, and again...
Spit when you say that word, please.
All I'll say is that, yeah, two.
Thank you.
The megafauna in Australia, going back tens of thousands of years, the rhododendrons and different megafauna, I've heard the evidence say that they were lost to the skills and the agility of and the speed of the early Aborigines. And I'm just curious to know what your...
Well, I'm afraid we didn't have a machine gun that operated spears. Have you seen the size of some of those creatures?
No.
Okay, there's a few models down in the museum. How even 20 or 30 spears could kill those creatures? It's not on. So, yes. Yes.
Long period of time, thousands and thousands of years, which would suggest that Aboriginal people weren't implicated in the extinction of the megafauna. And unlike North America, we don't have evidence of overkill sites.
Yeah.
There were really strict laws about, well, and with us anyway, particularly, we had really strict laws about taking creatures. Only the male could be taken. The other thing that I was drawing maps of our trade routes, And those trade routes can be traced by tracing the stories. Like we have stories of the Waratah, how the white Waratah became red. But so did the Ramangini, and they've never had a Waratah. So the story must have travelled all that way up. So you are able to trace, they call them songlines, we call them storylines. And you follow those storylines. But what you do is you have the logical trace. One of the other things I did was mapping and cartography. Mm-hmm. So, and I was able to do this. So, and aerial photography. So I was able to map the storylines. And I'd find that the storylines would be going very logically along the ridge lines. And then all of a sudden, where there was, you know, no reason, there would be a real bend around, a massive great bend around, and then it would continue on with the story. And that's where I found, more particularly, the place where I worked most with was down at Thirlmere Lakes. And that area there is magnificent. There's a legend about that area. That is where the trees began. And it's true because you keep getting new species coming up there all the time. And it's quite lovely, you know. You go to uni and find this, look what I've found. Oh, what a good girl you are. Yeah, so the whole thing was that then I started to realise we had some, not stories, but information that was passed down. Not quite in story form, and that was that there were areas of sanctuary, and I know of at least three now. These were sanctuaries where people, humans, were not allowed to go. And it's those areas that those trade routes took the route around. It's an indicator of those sanctuaries. And they were areas where the strongest animals and strongest creatures forced the weaker ones out. The weaker ones were the ones that we killed and ate. Okay? I've lost the minute.
So you might take just, one more question.
Help you put the megafauna and get them into context. Megafauna still exists, except they swim in the sea. And they're called whales. In the early colonial record, there's a story of a beaching of a whale at Manly Cove, in the colonial records, and something like 150 Aboriginal people gathered around feasting out. So the notion of coexistence and taking of megafauna opportunistically is at least witnessed in the early colonial times. I'd suggest to you, because the way we look at our existence, you can extend that opportunistic into the era of what you call megafauna. And the way we look at this is the earth is a resource to sustain our existence. To sustain our existence, we must sustain the resource. So it's a interwoven, interdependent cycle of continuing existence. To wipe out or overkill one is an interruption. Okay? So the concept of the whale as megafauna, whether that fits your megafauna description today or not, is another thing. Scientifically, it's another thing. But I would suggest that in the era of the megafauna, which is doing big digs up in Queensland and places like that. Okay. And remember, they were completely different climatic eras. It wasn't the Western Queensland environment that you know of today. Just as Mungo and that wasn't the dry, sandy dune lakes that you know of today. The coexistence and the at least the opportunistic taking advantage of a resource was a natural thing to have. Okay.
Jeremy, you had a question?
You referred to the other place another Aboriginal group where there wasn't Waratah, where were you referring?
Ramangini, up in Kakadu.
Okay.
Northern Territory.
Okay, I think we'll probably have to call today, but thank you so much, Auntie Fran, for coming along and that wonderful conversation. And I think, I'm not sure what's happening, I think there's some drinks somewhere, but I'm not sure. What's happening, Peter?
I believe back in the tea room that there is some light supper. I'm not quite sure.
Okay, all right. Thank you all so much for coming.
There's a good chance that there will be some light.
I'd like to thank both of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Well, thank you, huh? That's good.
Chase it, then it'd run far.
Okay, I'm going to head off.
Oh, okay.
Because that's the cat and me.
Oh, well, Matt. Okay, I'll see you later.
Do you want to take anything more?
Yes, please.